Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight on our program, we delve into the Mission District's vibrant artistic, cultural, and political history with author, professor, and San Francisco native, Carrie Cordova. In her new book, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco, Cordova establishes the Mission District as the home to a significant but largely ignored movement in Latino arts, which began in the 1960s and lasted for 40 years. This movement not only established a complex, multicultural, and politically active community, it also laid the groundwork for the later known Mission School of Arts. Cordova traces the impact of the Third World Strike at Bay Area college campuses and beyond, revolutions in Central America, U.S. imperialism, and the impact of the HIV/AIDS epidemic on mission artists and their art. She also describes how the issues that plague the mission and its residents today, such as lack of affordable housing, displacement, and marginalization, have always been a part of the history of the Latino community in San Francisco and of its artists. So, Dr. Carrie Cordova is currently an associate professor in the Department of American Studies and an affiliate for the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's author of the new book we'll be discussing tonight, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco, and is a native of San Francisco. So thank you for joining us, Carrie. Too bad I couldn't welcome you home literally into the studio, but thanks for joining us over the phone.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Joseph, for that lovely introduction.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation this evening. You can dial in about 20 minutes at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Carrie, if I can call you Carrie, your book starts with a jumping off point that says in 2002, there was this declaration in the Bay Guardian of the so-called Mission School of Art. And you said, wait a minute, there's been so much more art before this time. Tell us a little bit in a snapshot what your reaction to that declaration in 2002 was and how that propelled you to do this work.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, when you're working on a book, it's awfully hard to know where to start or where to begin. But there was something about that moment of the Mission School and the excitement of that. I mean, I had been looking at the history of the Mission for a while, and I was intrigued by what was being called the Mission School, and I think that there are many talented artists that were sort of constructed into that terminology. But what I found so surprising was the way in which it was crafted as a contemporary movement and seemed to not recognize the ways in which Latino artists especially, but artists of various backgrounds actually, had been working in the Mission District for not just a couple of years, but decades. And so I think that I started there as a form of critique, because the Mission School had gotten taken up by a lot of major art institutions, both local, national, and even international, and it seemed important to sort of say, look at this term, look at how it has blanketed over this neighborhood's very complex and long history that also has a deep politics to it.
So you decided you were going to start looking back. And how far back did you originally start to look? Or did you know you were going to look back as far as you did, which is your book stretches really from the 40s through the 90s. But you say that the Latino Mission Arts grew out of the 60s and then 70s, 80s, and 90s. How did you know that going into this?
No.
Or did you kind of keep peeling back the layers and going back decade after decade?
I fully anticipated that I was writing something that was probably starting in maybe the mid-60s or the early 60s at the earliest. I did not have a clue that my work was going to take me into even the 1930s or 40s. And it was a process of Because one of the questions, I think, to understand was, you know, how did the mission become Latinized, right? When did that happen? And there was, in general, an understanding that that happened in the 1960s. But I think the question for me became, well, where were Latinos before that? Because it's not as if they had just suddenly arrived in the city. And that's why it also became really important, because a lot of those constructions seemed to represent Latinos as new arrivals in the 1960s, and that wasn't the case at all. And it became important to look back at earlier neighborhoods in San Francisco, especially I ended up focusing a lot on the Latin Quarter, which we know today is the area around Broadway and Powell, sort of North Beach, or Little Italy or Chinatown near the Broadway Tunnel. And that area had been a mixed neighborhood, but because of the Church of Guadalupe, had become also a home for Latino residents in San Francisco in the early 20th century.
And you write that there's lots of artistic expression from the Latino residents of that neighborhood. How does that that expression differ from or feed into kind of what you start to see happen in the 60s in the Mission District?
Good question. I became really interested in the ways in which, a lot of the history I could do, I had less access to oral history for this period of time, but what I could do is try to look back at the stores and shops and sort of landscape of Broadway during this period. And even today, it still has a sort of entertainment district with a lot of restaurants. And then, you know, in the sort of height of World War II, it became a hotbed of nightclubs. And so for my work, it became important to look at how did these nightclubs, how did these restaurants present Mexican and Latino identities for consumption to San Franciscans and to tourists coming into the city. There's been some interesting work on a nightclub like Forbidden City, which was as it was called, an all-Oriental review. And in some ways, some of these nightclubs sort of followed that pitch, creating sort of a Mexican review. Or also in San Francisco, flamenco was really, really popular, and so that area had a lot of flamenco going on.
So it sounds like there was a way in which there was a predefined way in which the Latino artists that were living in the Latin Quarter were allowed to express themselves. That was based on expectations, based on financial motivations.
Exactly. And I think there was a way in which the culture could be sold and consumed, but it also became a space where artists could practice their work. And one of the things I became really interested in is the way in which Latin jazz took hold in those clubs, and a lot of musicians and performers, Pete Escovedo, sort of were running around. Cal Tater had sort of developed a lot of his performances there around Broadway, and so I was really interested in the ways in which that those musicians were working together and creating all of this new sound, a sort of West Coast sound, if you will, and what that meant when we also saw the disappearance of that culture. It sort of vanished, and we started to talk about only North Beach or Little Italy or Chinatown and what happened to that experience.
Before we move to the Mission, I want to stay with the Latin Quarter just for one more moment, because that area was obviously the epicenter of the beat community in this area. And how did Latino artists at that time influence, become part of, or not, that movement?
That was something I really wrestled with, and so I did it through the narrative of three artists that I ended up focusing on, male artists who had the most accessible stories for me. So Ernie Palomino, Jose Lerma, and Luis Cervantes, and I talked about the ways in which they were interested in abstract art. They were definitely sort of radical in their thinking, interested in pushing the boundaries of art, and yet they never really fit in to the Beat movement. And why was that? Was it simply on their end, or what was it also about the Beat movement that was often constructed as white and black, or literally a sort of racial binary of understanding of the Beats, when so many Latinos were actually coming to San Francisco to participate in alternative cultures at this time? And I talk a little bit about a Beat migration into the city. Poets like Nina Serrano, artists like Rene Yanez specifically came to San Francisco to participate in the Beats, but then were not necessarily feeling received within that community. So that and yet the Beats, of course, were so often associated with that North Beach area, and also thinking about the invisibility of Latinos in a neighborhood where they were living that had become a space for the counterculture.
Interesting to hear that, right? It's not a critique you often hear of the counterculture, that it was sort of exclusive in certain ways.
Yeah, I guess so.
So then what happened? How did people leave the Latin Quarter and move on to the Mission, what becomes the Mission District?
I feel like it's a story we San Franciscans all know so well. It's property values. Because of the appeal of that particular neighborhood, property values were escalating, and a lot of people started moving and started looking for new locations. There wasn't like a direct or obvious push into the Mission. But I did, in my book, point out that a couple of the storefronts I saw reposition themselves in the Mission. So they moved literally from Broadway into the Mission District neighborhood. And so there was some understanding that if you were conducting a Latino business, then maybe the Mission was the next location. I talk also a little bit about other smaller neighborhoods that were being redeveloped, right? And so thinking about the ways, even with the construction of the Bay Bridge or the sort of effort to redevelop lower downtown, and some of those neighborhoods were then, or those residents were looking for other spaces to live. And so you can partly see the Latinization of the Mission happening through that, as well as through new migrants coming from all parts of the Americas.
And so that's an interesting part of the equation here, right? There's the strong Mexican or Chicano identity, and then there is the feeding in from multiple parts of Latin America and Central America into that area. How does that get worked out? How do these identities, Chicano identities, identities of Central and South Americans, particularly Central Americans, get negotiated?
That's, again, a great sort of observation. I think that they don't, but I think that there is some way in which, how do I say this? Like, I was always struck growing up in the city, the ways in which there was such an emphasis on Latino or La Raza identity. And, you know, my family was from New Mexico, so we either, when visiting there, would experience a sort of either you're Hispanic or you're Spanish or maybe Mexican. And I think those experiences made me curious about how these different Latino identities were being shaped by place. And in San Francisco, it seems so important to recognize the diversity of Latino demographics in the city and the ways in which Latinos had joined to organize in a lot of different ways for you know, whether it was social organizations, unions, even through the arts, that led people to come together. And at the same time, there was always a sense of national difference or a sense of potentially not necessarily always at ease in these groupings.
So yeah, that was going to be my next question. What had to be laid aside, or what was sacrificed in terms of a greater good by having a more pan-Latin identity? And how did people hold on to their national origins in a way that either, you know, went parallel to that or intersected in a way that worked against the pan-Latin identity?
So one of my favorite stories is of a couple of artists, Rupert Garcia and another artist, traveling to Los Angeles and having a moment where they were attending a very Chicano-oriented meeting, and they sort of looked at each other and they said, "Man, I think we got to get out of here. This is like pure Chicanismo. It's like only, you know, about Chicanos." And both of these artists were Mexican American, but they had been working in the San Francisco community as activists. And so they had really adopted a sense of a sort of different coalitions. And I think that was part of what was intriguing to me, was to understand the ways in which San Francisco artists and activists had reached across national barriers to try to organize, but not always successfully. And so I think there's another artist from Guatemala who sometimes really felt like an outsider in the San Francisco Latino community, and so I think he struggled with that, Carlos Luarca. And so it was important not to make it an easy synthesis and just to say that everyone was really happy to work together. That wasn't quite how it was. And yet people saw a purpose in organizing around pan-Latino identity because there were issues of social equality to work out. There were issues of, especially if you're looking at the late 1960s and into the 70s, a sort of massive mobilization around civil rights that led people to reach out across various different otherwise divisions.
And how did this struggle, how did this attempt to negotiate the identities, how did that come out in the art itself? Did it get discussed? Did it get broadcast in the art? Or did that happen elsewhere?
It did. And I think it did, maybe not necessarily in the ways that people presume certain expectations sometimes for either Chicano art or Latino art. And one of the things that I was really intrigued by was the way in which in San Francisco there was such a preponderance and such a strong thread of abstraction, even when doing a lot of political work. And sort of thinking about, definitely there were posters, there was a lot of poster making, there was sort of outright sort of statements in some of the more didactic art. But then you could also see the ways in which some of the work by, say, Peter Rodriguez or Jose Lerma, or later maybe Gilberto Osorio, or even Patricio Rodriguez would push for images that were not easy to read. And yet I think those artists still understood their work as part of a sense of aesthetic difference.
Hmm. I just want to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the Mission District's vibrant artistic, cultural, and political history with professor and San Francisco native Carrie Cordoba, who just published a book talking about this very topic, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Do you live in the Mission, or did you live in the Mission during the period that is covered by this book, the 60s through the 90s? What are your memories of this time? We want to hear from you. How do you feel about the changing culture of the Mission and what has been lost? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisions@KALW. So you mentioned, Carrie, multiple times, artist and activist in the same sentence. Now, artists are often activists. Is there something specifically unique or specific to this group of artists over the years that you explored in the Mission that was particularly more activist or activist in a different way?
Yes, and I think that was also part of talking about the transition into the Mission District and sort of understanding also a difference of generations. And I think that some of the artists that I looked at in maybe the 1950s and early 1960s either veered away from some of the more strident activist art because it seemed maybe too didactic or too loud in some way, while others saw that this was a major opportunity. For instance, Yolanda Lopez talked a lot about the influence of the Black Panthers on her work and looking at sort of the influence of the UFW and Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, and thinking about the messages of boycott or shut it down, even, and looking especially at like a major moment in San Francisco was the Third World Strike, and how an event like that, a demand for higher education for people of color and greater representation, both as students and as faculty, became a larger call for thinking about curriculum, thinking about representation, thinking about images, and thus images became one of those major points of contestation, one of those ways in which you can start to talk about what is deemed beautiful, what is deemed mainstream, or what is deemed as other.
And so what I'm hearing is there's this kind of crosstalk between the political movements and the artistic, and where each sort of helps the other, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think I approached the project in a way thinking for various reasons, growing up around artists, I had seen the ways in which I might be able to tell this story through the lens of artist experiences and maybe using their work to talk about social change and transformation. And I think as I started doing that work, I realized that, you can't do it without also talking about the politics and the sort of community organizing that was going on simultaneously, that the ways, for instance, that the community mural movement that I write about really developing and taking off in the 1970s can't be divorced from some of the other community organizing that was happening in the city, or the ways in which artists were literally looking at ways to both defend the neighborhood, to speak to who was living in the neighborhood, to actually speak out against issues of gentrification even then, and then also to sort of encourage local residents to participate in community organizing activities and to see their experience in San Francisco's mission as part of a larger sort of cultural zeitgeist and shift.
So how was this very tight relationship between the political activism and the Latino artistic community in the mission? How did that in some ways, how did that constrain the appeal, the currency of the art and the artists? So did it sort of kind of plant it squarely in the mission? Did it speak outside of the mission? How did it affect the careers of those artists? Because they were so hyper-local in the work that they were doing.
Yeah. I mean, you might think that they were hyper-local, but actually, I worked on a book project called Beyond El Barrio, and it was so helpful for me because, I had been so sort of curious about how the barrio was typically represented or stereotyped as being very sort of either provincial or poor or narrow in scope. And then when you look at a place like the Mission, you realize how incredibly international it is, how incredibly sort of global the thinking was of a lot of these artists and the ways in which, so for instance, one of my chapters looks at poets, specifically Roberto Vargas, Alejandro Murguia, and Nina Serrano, and the ways in which, they part of their experience was they loved writing poetry, they were incredibly creative, they were deeply influenced, all of them, by the Beats, and sort of inspired to create different presses, right? So Alejandro Murguia in particular was participating in several different mini small presses in the city, and yet those three were also deeply involved in organizing around the Sandinista struggle in Nicaragua. And two of them, in fact, Vargas and Murguia, actually sort of famously went and fought with the Sandinistas towards the revolution. And so thinking about the ways in which part of looking at the mission required a sort of transnational narrative about a variety of different struggles.
But who did that art speak to? Did it speak to the people who shared the struggle? Did it speak to the people outside the struggle? To the people in power? Who was recognizing this art beyond the people for whom it was made? Or maybe I should say, for whom was it made?
I mean, if I could sort of imagine one of those artists speaking, I think it was made for the people of the mission. I mean, I think it was made for the Sandinistas. I think it was made for a variety of different groups. But I think one of the things that's maybe also worth acknowledging is that at sort of by the late 60s and 70s, a lot of people of color, a lot of artists of color, had dismissed the ways in which the art world had dismissed them. And so there was a sort of spirited, almost sort of separatist movement thinking, like, fine, we will create our own galleries. And thus they created Galleria de la Raza, or they created the Mission Cultural Center. And those were the spaces that were the audiences. Those were the people that were coming to inside the Galleria, the people that were visiting the Mission Cultural Center were certainly part of who was conceptualized as the listeners and the viewers.
So perhaps it's beyond the scope of your work, but I'm curious what you might think about that decision to say we're going to focus on the community for whom this art is for. Then what does that do in terms of the impact of that art, in terms of driving change? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I'm maybe not exactly following your line of inquiry. I mean, I think that if you're sort of pushing at the ways in which did these artists perceive of a very limited audience, and therefore their message was not necessarily reaching maybe some of the higher echelons, that could be true. And at the same time, these artists were actually working internationally. And so one of the things that I point out is that many of the muralists actually went to various other countries to do murals. The Latino artists in San Francisco were not just local, really. I mean, all of these artists, a lot of the ones that I write about have been picked up for major exhibitions, especially about Latino art, but also in a variety of other situations. But I don't think anyone had really talked about the ways in which San Francisco had been such a formative space for their work.
Fair enough. I wasn't necessarily. I didn't have a particular place I was going there. I was just trying to understand how the tension between focusing on local issues. How do you create a larger stage on which to have your work appreciated and to get your message out?
Yeah, but I think that's actually a really interesting question, because there was never just a focus on local issues. I mean, the focus was if you look at some of the work, there were concerns about Vietnam, there were concerns about Nicaragua, there were concerns about El Salvador, and all of those things were shaping the activism in San Francisco. Maybe sort of looking at different social issues abroad and thinking about what's happening there, what can we do there, but also thinking about what is the impact locally in San Francisco.
I'm going to take a pause here for a moment in our conversation, just to remind our listeners that we're in the middle of our fall membership drive and want to take a moment to ask for your support for programs like City Visions and for stations like KALW. And I'm joined again by David LaTulipe.
Hey, Joe. Hearing this conversation, it's just wonderful to have this kind of in-depth conversation on a local public radio station where you're not pressured to conform to any kind of constrictions or corporate need. We can have this conversation about what's going on right here in our local community. It's really wonderful. But it takes support to allow that to happen. And there's a number to call, 800-525-9917. A few people to thank that have been doing that during the conversation, which is the way we need to have things go. As you're enjoying this conversation with City Visions, make the phone call. Thank you, Dorothy in Mill Valley, Eileen Acker in Novato, and Matthew Ellinger in San Francisco, who stepped forward on this, our penultimate day of our fall membership campaign.
That's right. It's a couple of days left for you to be able to show your support in this.
No. Penultimate means the day before. So tomorrow's it.
Sorry.
No couple involved.
I stand corrected.
Tomorrow we hope to conclude it by 6 p.m.
That's true. Okay. I'll have to get my dictionary out. Okay. I'm going to stick to the safe message here. 1-800-525-9917 KALW.org to show your support for programs that bring you voices such as Carrie Cordova, a San Francisco native and professor who is now talking about the history of the Mission District and the Latino arts movement that spans decades there. Other programs such as Cross Currents and As It Happens and so many others, Your Call, these are only these are very specific KALW programs that we know you love and you come back to listen to every time. So show your support now by dialing 1-800-525-9917 or clicking on KALW.org.
I think the operative word of the year has been bloviation, Joe, in terms of everything from the networks to the fake news phenomena to our commander in tweet. In the White House, and it just makes listening to public radio more important than ever than it is right now. NPR and local stations like KLW provide a vital source of public information and dialogue about our democracy, and we hope you support that. 800-525-9917. A click is good as a call. Click KALW.org for a donation. But let's go back to your conversation now.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight I'm in conversation with Carrie Cordova. She is the author of the new book, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. And she's also a San Francisco native. And we invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Carrie, I wanted to go back to your discussion around the murals in the Mission. Something that is anyone who's traveled here as a tourist, it's on their to-do list. It's something that's very unique to the experience of San Francisco in many ways. Tell us about the murals, how they came about, and what's out there that's more than meets the eye.
I think some have actually dedicated entire books to the murals, even just in the Mission District, and deservedly so. So I had no pretensions of trying to tell the history of so much incredible visual culture. I mean, I have enjoyed it. I have, you know, really sort of marveled at some of the amazing creative work that exists on the walls on the exterior walls in San Francisco. But I think the way I did end up approaching it was maybe trying to give a sense of the origins in San Francisco of the community mural movement, and focusing on two particularly large murals that involved two teams of muralists, and I wanted to put their stories together, in part because those murals also had big receptions and a lot of press around them. And so I think looking at the community mural movement and where does it come from, I mean, its origins are probably a lot of different places. A couple of other authors have talked about the ways in which the community mural movement especially took off in Chicago and the Black Arts Movement there. In San Francisco, I tried to point out some of the earliest exterior murals were sort of in the early 70s. There were murals that were interior, but in the early 70s is really when you see the community mural movement and all those exterior murals taking off. Part of it was also tied to a level of enthusiasm, I mean, activism, right, sort of painting the walls and thinking about the messages that you could create for city residents to have a shared experience through those walls, and maybe even encourage a shared politics through those walls. And then part of it was also sort of thinking about maybe trying to make a safer space. One of the artists that I write about, Mia Gonzalez, talked about Bobby Alley and how she really wanted to create a safe space for children to be able to walk through Bobby Alley to Garfield Park, and it did not feel safe in those years. And so thinking about how could you make it beautiful and make it safe for children, and she started painting on the walls of Bobby Alley with children. And and then the Mujeres Muralistas, a mural group a group of different talented women, it sort of varied in composition, but perhaps especially Patricia Rodriguez, Graciela Carrillo, and a couple of others who wanted to join into wanted to paint their back wall, really. So they were living on Balmy Alley and painting a mural there. And so those are factors that were launching part of it. And then also thinking about things like CETA helped. CETA was the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, and San Franciscans, especially John Kreidler, got an idea to maybe try to employ artists through CETA in the same way that the U.S. government had employed artists through the WPA. And so some murals actually were pushed forward through CETA, and that sort of started a culture, if you will. And then I ended up focusing on one mural that was created. I called it the Hombres mural, the mural painted by men, especially Chuy Campuzano, Luis Cortazar, and Michael Rios in the Bank of America, and another mural painted by the Mujeres Muralistas not far away, and the kind of different messages and aspirations that each of those murals relayed.
And what of... Is there a sort of a gender politics to the art of that was expressed in the mission, or tensions between between female artists, male artists? Was there a lot of connection and collaboration?
No, there was a lot of tension. I mean, these artists, they were good friends, and they hung out a lot, and. Yet, at the same time, I think the Mujeres Muralistas in part formed because they felt a lack of inclusion, and they were sort of like, fine, you know, we're going to do it ourselves. We're going to get our own scaffolding, and we are going to create our own idea, our own sort of aesthetic vision, and so be it. And I'm not sure that the guys ever really even conceptualized of like what that meant, or the ways in which they might not always have been including women in the process. And so part of that chapter was really just exploring the ways in which women artists struggled for visibility, even in this larger scene of invisibility and civil rights.
Right. So the layers of invisibility, of suppression, oppression, that sort of replicate themselves, it sounds like.
Yes.
So were there other themes or struggles within Latin culture, pan-Latin culture, that also kind of were expressed or worked out? Because a lot of what you've talked about up till now is a very liberal, pro-communist or anti-capitalist message that was propagated in a lot of the art. Were there critiques of Latin culture beyond sort of a group of women coming together as muralists to say, "Hey, we can do this too," that was negotiated or displayed in the art?
Yes, I mean there was never any sort of Pollyanna kind of sweet everyone getting along kumbaya. There were all kinds of conflicts. There were divisions about, like, you know, what should the Mission Cultural Center be, and who gets to decide. There were sort of aesthetic divisions. I can recall one artist feeling like the Galleria de la Raza was always much more Mexican or Mexican-American centric or Chicano centric. And, you know, a different gallery was, you know, more inclusive, right? And so there were these, I don't know if they're exactly rivalries, but points of dissension, points of dissent. I do talk a little bit about the fact that a lot of the work and activism out of San Francisco was very leftist. I mean, there's no getting around that. I sort of describe it as a kind of global left politics rather than a sort of binary understanding of left and right in the United States, maybe sort of thinking about a global left as sort of joining around a shared struggle for human rights around the world. And certainly the organizing in San Francisco was very much about that. If you were to look at, say, Miami or other cities, that would not be the case. So one of the things was also to sort of, in looking at San Francisco, consider the ways in which it was a very different Pan-Latino community from other urban centers, and how did that happen, and why did that happen? And so part of it was about that politics. It's not to say that there weren't conservative Latinos in San Francisco, because there definitely have been. I think another Salvadoran artist talked about a sort of backlash against some of the organizing around the leftist FMLN struggle in San Francisco. And so, you know, these things were not easy. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to make that clear, even as I also wanted to talk about the Mission as an incredible space for community organizing and for art.
So it sounds like any movement, it wasn't monolithic in its, although there was quite definitely a sort of, it leaned left, but it wasn't monolithic in terms of the expressions or the messages that it was trying to portray.
Exactly.
So let's talk a little bit more. Let's get into the 80s now. So let's talk about the revolutions in Nicaragua and El Salvador, and how this the artists and the activists who were here, how were they connected to it in very concrete ways and in visual ways. What was the connection between the community here and those areas?
Well, I think one of the things that I tried to sort of thread through the book was the ways in which the Central American population in San Francisco always played an important role in shaping Latino politics in the city. San Francisco, partly, I guess, as a port city, had a large coffee trade early on, and the port had sort of created a constant migration between places like Nicaragua and El Salvador, so that when the wars in Central America escalated in the 1970s and 1980s, that migration to the city spiked. And at that time, of course, the reports of, you know, incredible human rights violations and incredible violence that were happening in Central America were reaching the world. And San Franciscans, both migrating from those, or San Franciscans sort of, I don't know if I want to say welcomed, but they took up those issues and they tried to welcome some of those migrants and sort of set up spaces of resistance. So
that's where our sanctuary city policy emanates from, right?
That's exactly that moment. And in fact, I had mentioned Bomb Alley, and maybe one of the things about Bomb Alley to remember is that the very first painting, like mass painting of Bomb Alley, was in 1984, and specifically to protest U.S. intervention in Central America, and also to express solidarity with Central Americans and sort of a shared sense of vulnerability, I guess. And so, that was one of those, I guess, artistic turning points in terms of thinking about Bomb Alley as a major historic and artistic site, and then sort of thinking about, like, these global politics, were so fundamental to shaping that art.
And so then the other part of the 80s is the AIDS epidemic. Tell us how that impacted the community and what was the artistic response to that, and how did it dovetail or not with the otherwise dominant gay white male response to the AIDS crisis in this city?
Yes, I mean, I, in sort of pursuing this work, I realized that I did want to do a chapter on Dia de los Muertos or Day of the Dead. And I especially wanted to sort of link it to some of these events in the 1980s because I thought that they that the event, Day of the Dead, changed over the course of the 1980s in San Francisco, in part because of this level of social violence, both in Central America and the fact that so many people were dying in San Francisco, that there was this sense of just incredible loss and a need for mourning. And so Day of the Dead could be a vehicle to express that kind of loss. And I became very interested in how did that happen? How did Day of the Dead also become a space for artistic expression, because I don't know, maybe some of your listeners are familiar with some of the dramatic altars that sort of escalated in scale and scope and that spoke out politically. And so that was part of my work, was trying to think about how did Latinos mourn for people with AIDS, and how did they mourn for people dying in El Salvador. And so that became part of that sort of penultimate chapter, if you will.
And there again, perhaps another tension point in terms of you know, Dia de los Muertos having somewhat of a cultural religious overtones, and how did the Latino community accept HIV and AIDS in their own community?
So I think if you're I tried to look at sort of the moment of diagnosis, or sort of looking at the early 1980s. I was curious about when I could find an altar dedicated to AIDS, and the first one that I was able to find was in 1984, and you know, I think it could have happened earlier. many people had already died at that point, but I think that Juan Pablo Gutierrez's altar for AIDS, or SIDA, as it's called in Spanish, made an impact. And there was even some nervousness about having an altar about this. And yet, I think it was Juan Pablo telling me that a couple came into Galleria de la Raza and saw this altar, appearing a slightly conservative Latino couple, Spanish dominant, and their son had just died of AIDS, and they saw the altar, and I think they stayed there and they cried. And so, I mean, I think that moment of grief was such an illustration of the ways in which the Latino community was also grieving, and yet often, more often painted as either super conservative or intolerant, and not necessarily also struggling against this epidemic.
So in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to bring it back to the present day and to the theme that runs throughout your book of displacement of various sorts, either within this city or the migratory patterns of refugees from the Central American revolutions and wars. What's your take on sort of where things stand today in terms of the legacy of the art and the artists and the politics that you write about in your book? What place does it take in the current conversation of the art of that neighborhood and of the population that lives and still struggles to live there?
Well, I'm really hopeful that I've created a different narrative about the Mission School. I'm really hopeful that when that term is applied, that there's going to be a sort of greater reckoning with what that means and a sort of longer neighborhood politics. I wish I could tell the future. I work more as a historian than a fortune teller, and I worry, like so many other San Francisco residents, about the future of the city, and especially in light of the displacement of so many low-income people, so many seniors. I talk a little bit about, at the end, about the ways in which, you know, one of the major transformations of San Francisco is that it once was a place that you could go if you were poor and wanted to be an artist and you wanted to sort of be creative, and that is simply not the case anymore. And I don't know if that means I don't think it means that the history that has happened there is lost. I think that happened, and it's really important to remember. But I also think that the city is in a point of transition and transformation, and I'm really hopeful that we can still try to create places for art and for these concerns about human rights and welfare.
And maybe this legacy will help give people the energy they need to find a way to make that happen. I want to thank my guest this evening, Dr. Carrie Cordova, Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies and an affiliate of the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the new book, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang. And please join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday for a discussion of racial segregation in the Bay Area. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.